Hi, folks. This is episode 2 of the second season of Cut Jib Newsletter Speaks. Sefton is still building shelves in the wilds of Wisconsin. He moved recently from the sewer that is known as New York City, or New York City, which is now known as a sewer, and he is a bit busy. Our second season will be in fits and starts, I think, for the next month or so. But in the meantime, I was able to finagle some actual expertise. So please welcome Dave in Florida, who is our resident expert on all things polling and voting.
Well, happy to be here and happy to be in the second season. I guess I made the cut since I've made it to season 2.
Absolutely. You don't drool on the mic, and that's pretty much better than me and Sefton. So, you know, hopefully you'll be a regular. Anyway, let's get to it. The reason I asked you to join us or join me today is that the last month or so, it seems like the Senate races have been heating up. There's been a lot of nasty rhetoric, obviously, primarily from the Democrat side, because they're simply better at being nasty than the Republicans. And there have been a fair amount of possibly substantive stuff thrown, in particular in Georgia, which fascinates me. So if you don't mind, we can start there.
I am happy to do it. Happy to start there. So let me just put paid to Georgia. Walker's going to win there. Warnock is not going to win that race. Bar significant cheating. And the problem in Georgia is that any cheating that's going to happen there is going to be on the Republican side. So it's pretty much inconceivable that you're going to have cheating that benefits Kemp but does not benefit Walker at the same time. So that's going to be pretty hard for them to pull off.
Well, that's good to hear. I also like the idea that the Republican Party is not above cheating, because they're certainly above fighting. perhaps being in the shadows and being sneaky the way Mr. McConnell is more their style.
You know, here's the problem with Mitch McConnell. Okay, if you look at actual polling and the opinions, he's the most disliked person in Congress right now. And if you look at it a certain way, he's even more disliked than Nancy Pelosi. Because here's the problem: while everybody hates Nancy Pelosi, Democrats do like her. McConnell has a problem of no one likes him. Neither Republicans nor Democrats like McConnell. So he ends up being, he polls at, I could pull it, I don't have it in front of me, but I could pull it up pretty easily. But he polls at something like 13% favorable or something like that. It's just a ridiculously low number. So I'm almost happy that he says nothing, because there's nothing he could say that would help anybody.
The problem, at least for me, it's not that he's saying nothing, although I think that, I wrote earlier on Ace of Spades that I think that he should be on his bully pulpit railing against the socialist policies of the Democrats. But the fact that he's saying nothing is okay. The real problem is that he is, according to some reports, he is actively fighting against the MAGA movement in the United States. And is it conceivable that he would rather be in the minority in 2023 than have 30 or 40 MAGA conservatives in the House and Senate?
I think he would prefer, and this goes from McCarthy as well, they would prefer to be in the majority by a slim amount. And that will probably be the case in the Senate. And they would love it if they could end up coming into 2023 with like a 10 seat majority. That means they are in charge. They have all the committee assignments, but they don't have so much of a advantage that there's an expectation that they will actually be able to do anything. You know, they can run failure theater forever at that point, because they can always say, oh, we just didn't have the votes to make it. Oh, our lead is just too small. Donate more money to us so we can increase our majority that will allow us to actually win next time and be able to do things for you this time, even though we've promised this for 30 years and never delivered, even when we had a 40-seat majority. So, I mean, that's what he would like. Now, I'm not convinced that he or McCarthy have much control, you know, beyond them at the margins. You know, they can lose a seat or two here or there, probably in the House more than the Senate. I think there's maybe only one seat in the Senate that McConnell can actually influence. But ultimately, I think here's my theory. I think McConnell's only going to be in the Senate another year and a half. I think he is waiting for the 23 governor election in Kentucky, because then most likely Beshear, I can't remember how to pronounce his name, but the Democrat that's the governor there, he is probably going to lose in 23. And I think McConnell wants a Republican to go in, somebody that he has some influence over, so he can then retire and name identify one of his cronies to take over that seat. And once his crony is appointed to the seat, then he's the odds-on favorite to win in Kentucky going into, I think 24 is when he's up again. Now, I might have that wrong. It might be 26, but no, it's 24. It's 24. He won in 2018. So I think that's the deal he's playing. I think he would want to be. I don't think he's playing to lose necessarily, but his heart isn't in it. You know, he clearly would prefer that the people who have won the primaries not be the nominees. So he's probably isn't going to bend over backwards to do anything and just try to save as much money in the senatorial fund that he can.
Which goes where? I don't recall how the general fund for the Senate.
I think it pretty much just stays there.
Oh, okay.
I think anything they don't spend just stays in that fund. I mean, it's not like it goes into his pocket.
So
later.
It's not, he's probably done with that. He's probably got for his family and their families. And,
yeah, he's made his money. I mean, you know, China has made him very wealthy, I'm sure. So speculation on my part, I'm not saying I know anything there.
What, that he's a crook? Or that he's leaving?
Well, in both cases, I'm more confident that he's leaving after the governor's race in Kentucky than I want to go on record as saying.
Okay.
He's a crook and is stealing money and being paid off by the Chinese. That might be my suspicion, but I don't have any evidence.
So let's move west and take a look at Nevada, the Senate race in Nevada.
This one I don't have good numbers on. My gut feel is that probably Laxalt is going to win that. And the reason is he's a good candidate and he does have a background in the state. That state has been heavily moving, much like Arizona, has been heavily moving the Hispanic population toward the Republicans. So what you've got the same phenomena happening that you just saw play out in the Arizona primary is also happening in, I'm sorry, my wife is from there. She gets mad at me when I say say Nevada. She gets so mad at me if I don't say Nevada. Anyway, Laxalt is going to benefit from that same dynamic where there are a lot of new first-time Hispanic voters that are leaning Republican but are slipping past the likely voter screen for a lot of the polls. And you saw this happen in the primaries where male Hispanics turned out for Masters and Lake in very large numbers. And most of the polling missed it because they did not believe when they polled male Hispanics, they said, oh, you're a low propensity voter. We don't expect you will actually vote. And turned out that they did, you know, in a primary, no less. And you're going to see that same phenomena in Nevada, where the same group, the same types of people. And that's a state that's been even more economically devastated by the lockdowns and all of the policies than you saw in Arizona.
Yeah, I can't imagine what happened in Las Vegas.
Oh, that
Reno, that must have destroyed them.
Yeah, Las Vegas, just, you know, they're tough times there.
So the Hispanic vote in Nevada is sufficiently upset at the state of the country and the state of the state that they will look past the fact that the incumbent has a Mexican name. I'm assuming Mexican. Cortez, right?
Yeah.
Catherine Cortez. Boy. Masto.
Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about Pennsylvania and we talk about Arizona, you're going to say I'm going to have kind of the same thing. She's not a very good candidate. Okay? She hasn't really made much of a name for herself. So there's not a real good compelling reason to vote for her. And again, Laxalt is a name that is known in the state. So he's not coming in. He's not coming in with baggage like you've got Oz in Pennsylvania from, you know, from Turkey. People will feel pretty comfortable voting for him. He is known there. And you do have a very large upswing with the Hispanic vote, especially in not the West Coast, not the coast, but the Mountain West region. You're going to see this in Colorado, not so much in Utah. You could see it in, you know, you'll see the effect in New Mexico, even though I don't think it's going to change any of the races there. You're definitely going to see it in both Nevada and in Arizona.
Well, let's move to Arizona.
Arizona, Masters should win that. Okay, he is actually a very good candidate. Now, here's the deal. There, a lot was made about, oh my God, they're pulling funding out of that. Well, here's the thing. Masters used to work for Peter Thiel. Thiel, is that? I think the H is silent.
Yeah.
He used to work for Peter Thiel. He has been funded. His campaign has been funded by Peter Thiel. So you've got a kind of a funding standoff where the senatorial committee doesn't want to put any money into that and force Peter Thiel to fund him.
Makes sense. I mean, he's a billionaire.
Right.
In case folks don't know, he's a VC. He's a venture capitalist.
Right.
I don't know what else he does, but he's got enough money to fund any race in the United States.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Peter Thiel is he has been the single individual that has been funding all of the alternative media that we make use of right now. So I'm not sure if Rumble's the right is one of them, but alternatives to YouTube, alternatives to Facebook, alternatives to Twitter. You know, he's been the guiding force behind a lot of those alternative media platforms that you now see conservatives moving to in order to avoid censorship. So anyway, let me stick with Masters for a minute. The problem is, now Kelly, if you take away his voting record, has a pretty compelling story. Astronaut, you know, his wife was shot. If he was just running for the first time, he would probably win. And I've heard interviews with Masters, and Masters says the whole strategy he's got, he has to get, is he has to tie Kelly to his voting record. Mm-hmm. Okay. And unlike Sinema, Kelly has voted in lockstep. Masters' best argument is to just say, hey, look, he could have been with Sinema opposing things for the good of Arizona. He didn't do that. Whatever Chuck Schumer said to vote for, he just voted for it automatically. And you now see campaign ads for Kelly where he's saying things like, and we should secure the border. Well, where were your votes before on that? So Kelly's actually running away from his record. So it really comes down to, can Masters tie Kelly to his voting record? And that should make the difference. The same people that in general are going to vote for Lake are also going to vote for Masters. It's just Kelly's a better candidate than Katie Hobbs is. Did I have that right? Is her first name Katie? I know something. It's Hobbs. Yeah.
Okay, let's take a short segue into the governor race in Arizona, because I find that fascinating.
That's over. Carrie Lake's going to win. Oh, okay. Yeah, please. There's no, put it this way. Charlie Crist has as much of a chance of winning in Florida as Hobbs does of winning in Arizona. Okay. I mean, Carrie Lake is just a tremendously dynamic character, and she's running against somebody who is terrible. I mean, the Democrats just put a terrible candidate up for governor. So she's not going to win by a lot. Okay. You know, she'll win, but she should win by about 5 points or so. And I could be wrong. I won't be surprised if she were to walk away winning by 15. I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't want to predict a margin that large, not in Arizona.
How are the policies in Arizona to prevent large-scale voter fraud?
People forgot, because I got caught by this as well, because when the primary election was going on, I was thinking, oh, my God, you know, they're stealing it from Lake. You know? And I got snookered by the way the results came in. I did not realize what they reported first was early vote, which naturally favored Robeson. Everybody forgot that the voters in Maricopa tossed out the original secretary of elections in Maricopa and replaced them back in 2021 with a Republican. So the guy who is running the Maricopa elections now is pretty clean. And plus, they did do, there were changes. The Arizona voting rolls were cleaned up, and there were a lot of integrity measures. Well, not a lot, but some significant integrity measures were put in place in Arizona, which was one of the reasons why it took so long for them to do the counting. I mean, what was it, like 4 days before we won?
It was painful.
It was painful. It was absolutely painful. But the reason was is they were doing signature verification against all of the mail-in ballots. Okay, something that was not done in 2020. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So they were verifying those ballots, and you know, so that was an election integrity measure that was put in place, probably kind of the first time they've run it this year. So I kind of, once I understood what was going on, I kind of backed off, said, okay, I know it's taking them days and days, which is ridiculous because Florida can count a state 10 times larger in 3 hours. But, you know, hey, at least they're doing the, you know, verifying the integrity of the election this time so that nobody can question it, which, you know, if I was in their shoes, that'd be kind of what I wanted to do as well. I would not want this election to come under the same scrutiny the last one did.
So let's shift to the Midwest. Let's go to the upper Midwest and Wisconsin. How is that looking?
There have been a couple polls that have been out. Here's the problem with Wisconsin. The gold standard, so to speak, for Wisconsin is Marquette. Well, Marquette has gotten everything wrong for the last several cycles. They had Biden plus 15 in 2020, which ended up even with the cheating, Biden only won by, you know, by what, like 10,000 votes. So even with Biden winning, they were off by a lot. And so any poll that comes out of Wisconsin right now, where I'm having a problem is nobody's polling Wisconsin I really trust at the moment. When I'm in a situation like that, I look at candidate action. I mean, what are the candidates doing? And what I see is Ron Johnson continuing to hold one of the few people that's holding Biden's feet to the fire, you know, both on January 6th and vaccine mandates and various other things. If he was running scared in that race, he would not be poking the Democrat administration the way he is right now. So my feeling is he probably is in good shape and feels like he's got a comfortable lead going in.
I'm sorry, but his opponent is a guy named Mandela Barnes, who, as far as I can tell, is a hard left maniac.
Yeah,
that's, you know, he's the kind of candidate who would win in a blue wave, in a Democrat wave
right.
election.
And that's not happening this time.
No, I really don't think it's, I mean, worst case, it's not going to happen.
Here's the thing. And you're going to see this nationwide. Any place Trump gets involved, that pulls forward the Republican candidates by a lot. And Trump has been involved in Wisconsin. In the governor's race there in Wisconsin, what was her name? Killfish, Kleinfish, something like that. You know, lieutenant governor, actually pretty good politician, decent person. You know, she should have won. The Trump-endorsed candidate just killed her. And that was because Trump came and pushed for his candidate and the voters turned out. And, you know, you're seeing this across the country. If Trump says, I want you to vote for this person, they vote for that person. If Trump stays out of it, nobody cares. You saw that in New York 19. Okay. Nobody showed up.
Let's hold that thought. If Trump says vote, we vote for his candidate. Back to Touch It Newsletter Speaks. Lucky enough to have Dave in Florida here today discussing the polls. And right now we're talking about the Senate races that are going to be interesting in the United States. And He provided me with a perfect segue into Pennsylvania.
So I have numbers for Pennsylvania, actual fresh off the press polling from Pennsylvania that I trust. And I'll tell you, full credit, this is all from Richard Barris. He just finished a Pennsylvania poll, pretty decent poll right now. So four slices of this I want to talk through, because it's really important to understand how all of this relates to each other. So first of all, taking a look at Biden's approval and then Trump versus Biden, you know, hypothetical 2024 election. I know we're talking about the midterms, but this does impact what I'm going to say later. So I want to set this up. First of all, in Pennsylvania, strongly disapprove, not just disapprove, strongly disapprove of Biden, 50%. Huge, huge number of people.
That's amazing.
Want to hear the good one? Males. Strongly disapprove of Biden, 67.7%. That's two out of every three men in Pennsylvania disapprove of Biden's job performance. So having that, now you take a look at, okay, well, how if in a hypothetical 2024, it's the Trump versus Biden, how does that break down? Trump currently has 46.6% to Biden's 40%, 40 flat. Okay, so that's a 6.6% lead for Donald Trump in a hypothetical matchup. Now, no polling of Pennsylvania in 2020, including Richard Barris, ever showed Trump with a lead. No poll ever showed Trump leading. Barris himself always was coming up Biden plus two, Biden plus one or two in Pennsylvania. So that's easily for Trump an 8-point shift in approval.
So I'm going to stop here one second and ask a question. That is, I have to assume that one of the reasons why you trust Barris is that he doesn't change his technique. So he's not radically altering his polling technique from 2020 to 2022.
No, he's using the same technique. He does a combination of online questionnaires and SMS polling. And he says SMS has been working pretty good the last couple cycles. Some polling methods are just not working at all. And one of the interesting things is, and I recently just learned this, is his methodology of weighting is completely by demographics. He doesn't even wait for party ID. And his argument is that party ID shifts. So by going with, you know, I need so many Republicans, I need so many Democrats, that's not valid. That it naturally comes out in the wash when you get an appropriate demographic sample of X number of people from the different counties you need to get out at different socioeconomic impacts, different races, different ages. As long as all of the demographics actually fit the model of what the state looks like, which he bases off of consumer data. You know, so he has, you know, millions of records that he gets from consumer data to know what the actual demographics are of a location that he's polling. And then when he's doing the polling, he oversamples into those demographics until he gets a sample that's representative of the actual demographics of the location. That's why his polling has been so accurate for the last several cycles.
Yeah, that's obviously less easily manipulated.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. All right.
Exactly. Okay, we've set that up, you know, Trump versus Biden. So keep that in mind. Over 6% lead for Trump in Pennsylvania. Okay, so now let's take a look. Governor. What's he finding for governor? Well, Shapiro is leading by a half a point, 43.9 to 43.2. That's a very, very minor lead that Shapiro has over Mastriano. And then you go take a look at the Senate race, and currently he's coming up with Oz about 3.84, you know, close to 4% down to Fetterman. Okay, so it's 43.8 to 40.0. Now, here's where it becomes really interesting. One thing, the reason I want to point out Trump, keep in mind, Trump is running ahead of both of the candidates. Trump is more popular in Pennsylvania than the Republican Senate candidate and the Republican governor's candidate. You know, he's 3 points ahead of the governor of where the governor race is, and he's 6 points ahead of where the Senate race is. Now, I'll say right up front, I don't think Oz is a very good candidate, although he is doing the right things to win this race. He has not spent time, and surprisingly, he has not spent his time going and doing TV all the time. And given that he's a TV guy, you would expect that to be the thing. Instead, he's been going out to all of the communities, going to the basically hitting the road, all of the different communities throughout Pennsylvania, meeting people. You know, he's doing the retail politics thing to get to know the constituents and to get them to actually get to know him. So when Trump gets involved, the fact that he has higher popularity than the candidates, and you see this nationwide, this isn't just Pennsylvania, this is just an excellent example of it. He increases it. He pulls people in. He gets people excited, and he gets people that are on the edge to make that decision. So here's where I know I've said this is interesting a couple times now, but on the Senate race, there's still 10% undecided. So it comes down in this race. What's going to happen with those undecideds? Are they going to vote or not? Well, this is a likely voter poll. Rich Barris believes that this 10% undecided are definitely going to vote. He is convinced that these people are not going to stay home, that these are very likely to vote. And now they're just not saying who they're going to vote for. Well, if you take a look at the issues that are important to that group, the issues that are most important to that group of undecided is the economy. 44% of those undecideds, their top issue is the economy. And then you look, and they're picking from a range of 13 some issues. So you got a 6% that say abortion and 2% that say gun rights and things like that. But almost 50% of those undecideds are going to be voting on the economy. Well, who are they going to vote for? They're not going to vote for the Democrat. They're not going to vote for Fetterman. You know, and that's the bottom line for both the governor and for the Senate race. So my feeling right now, I think Mastriano is going to win the governor's race. I don't think that's caveat. People are going to vote. The majority of the voters are going to vote for Mastriano. I'm not predicting the actual outcome of the election. And I think for Oz, it's probably about a 50-50 at this point. Fetterman does have a lead, but Fetterman is such a terrible candidate.
He's unbelievably bad. And, you know, adding in a debilitating stroke certainly doesn't increase his chances of, you know, making strong attachments with the undecided voters.
Yeah, it's never good. And Hobbs in Arizona had the same thing. When you decide you will not debate your opponent, that never goes well. The voters hold that against you badly. Even if there's a reason for it, you know, they're not going to forgive you for it. They're just going to say, well, you shouldn't even be running them. You had a stroke and you can't talk. Therefore, you won't debate. Why are you even here?
So for a variety of reasons, I've been in Philadelphia several times a year for the last several years. And I was last there this past weekend in the nicest part of Philadelphia, which is Center City, and slightly to the west and slightly to the north. And the city of Philadelphia has decayed significantly, even over what it was 6 months ago, when it wasn't very pleasant 6 months ago. The number of aggressive panhandlers, of obviously aggressive pretty much every kind of street person all over the place, and the interesting passivity of the police in the face of that would suggest to me that, if anything, the Democrat machine in Philadelphia is not covering itself in glory. And they're the ones who can push Fetterman and what's his name? Shapiro. Yeah. Over the top.
And they have to.
And if they don't, then it's entirely possible that both Oz and Mastriano will win. And this is, I mean, because it is so obvious that Democrat policies have failed in Philadelphia. It's not a clever interpretation of subtle facts. It's in your face anywhere you go in that entire city. So hopefully the people of Philadelphia will not be energized to assist in the theft.
Of course, the problem with Philadelphia is how many of those people actually voted in the first place. I mean, they probably have the ballots printed out and filled in already, just waiting to put them into the system. Yeah, it always in Pennsylvania, it's always a matter of, I kind of back of the envelope pretty much assume that Philadelphia can generate about 200 to 300,000 fraudulent votes, and then whatever happens to the rest of within the rest of the state has to overcome that level of fraud, which is why I ended up having Pennsylvania wrong when Trump came in a million votes ahead. I just said, well, Philadelphia can't overcome that, and no, they sure as hell were able to find 1.2 million fraudulent additional votes to change that election. Okay, but they did that because they had mail-in voting available.
So I'm going to stop you right now, and here's a parenthetical expression for our listeners. So Dave in Florida is quite the empiricist, and he is obviously uncomfortable with predictions that are not based on fairly significant data. And what he just said is chilling. He is speaking in a very matter-of-fact tone about the theft of a presidential election, with in one state 1.2 million votes that were, in his estimation, fraudulent. And if that isn't a wake-up call for America, then nothing can be.
The total number nationwide of fraudulent votes for Biden was probably about 5.5 million. This is easily determined by doing a comparison of nationwide polling, asking who did you vote for. And the math is easy to say, I poll, I find this many people say I voted for Biden, this many people say I voted for Trump. I compare that to the actual election results. These numbers don't match. There are 5.5 million people missing from that comparison. You know, when you extend that math out nationwide. So yeah, 5.5 million, easily over a million of those in Philadelphia, between Philadelphia and Pittsburgh, state of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I've heard descriptions of Pennsylvania as being Alabama, with Pittsburgh and Philadelphia.
Yeah. So Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, with Alabama in between them. So, and in terms of actual votes, no question, Mastriano will win the governor's race. We'll get the most votes in the governor's race. And I think Oz probably will get the most votes in the Senate race once the election is finished. There's still an introduction that Oz has to do to just how bad a candidate Fetterman is. Yeah. But the undecideds right now sitting outside, there are more than enough undecideds in both races to swing it. And those undecideds aren't going to be voting for Democrats, and they say they're going to vote. So there's an interesting, I'm sorry, I keep using that word. If you take a look at the generic ballot, which I also have numbers on, there has been a quote unquote tightening generic ballot between Republican and Democrat. So Republican is still 2.5 or a point and a half ahead of Democrat, which in any normal year would be just an amazing thing. Oh my God, the Republicans are going to have a red wave if the generic ballot shows them even a point ahead. Because normally generic ballot is like 3 points Democrat, you know, in general. But that is a quote unquote tightening from where we were earlier in the summer, in June. So what happened? Why did people suddenly say, nah, I'm not going to vote for Republicans? No. What happened? The Democrat number has remained the same. Democrat candidate preference is 41.2, and it's been pretty much 41 for the last 6-8 months or so. What happened in August is you started seeing the Republican number come down, and those get transferred into the undecided column. Why would they do that? Why would people who were confident 3 months ago that they were voting Republican now say they don't know? Because these people are voting. Why would they say that? So there's really interesting, I did it again, I'm sorry. There's a number that I have here.
It sounds like you're using the word interesting to avoid saying the word suspicious.
Yeah, well, this one is not suspicious. This just tells me what's going on. If you ask the voters, are they comfortable sharing their political beliefs with various groups, their friends, their family, their neighbors, come down to the end, pollsters, what do they say about sharing their beliefs, their political beliefs with pollsters? Well, Democrats, pretty comfortable in telling pollsters what they think. Same thing for Republicans. Republicans also are pretty comfortable telling pollsters what they think. Where you see a big difference is in independents. These were earlier in the year saying, I'm voting Republican. Now these people are saying, and the number I've got here between somewhat uncomfortable and very uncomfortable is 45.2%. of independents are not comfortable giving their opinions to pollsters. Well, think about what's been going on right now. You've got the Nazi speech in Philadelphia. You've got cancel culture going left and right. You've got former presidents being raided. You have new IRS agents being hired. Well, not surprising that people say, you know, when the time comes for me to vote, I'll do it in secret, and I don't need to tell anybody right now because I don't need to be put on somebody's list. So I think that's what we're seeing. This tightening in the generic ballot is based not on Democrats getting more popular, but instead people who are going to vote Republican are not willing to tell people that they're going to vote Republican because, you know, they view it as a risky scenario to share their opinions with other people, especially with pollsters.
This is, you know, you're being depressing and optimistic at the same time. So you mentioned something very interesting. You mentioned SMS polling, and I got an SMS message a couple of days ago, and it was a poll. It was for my congressional election. I'm in New Jersey 5. Josh Gottheimer is running against his opponent from 2018 or 2020. And, you know, something I forgot the guy's name. It's so ridiculous. And the questions were very, very interesting because they were guiding my answers, and it was pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it was a little irritating. So I put on one of my personas, which was I'm a 60-year-old Hispanic independent voter, and I am a strong believer in defending the borders. So we'll see what they make of that. They'll probably just toss it because they think that I'm a lunatic. But anyway, it was the first time I'd ever been able to complete one of those polls because they usually kick me after about two questions.
Okay, so here's the thing. They already know who you are, and they already have your demographics.
Yes.
So when you tell them you're Hispanic, they're sitting there looking at the voter file and saying, no, he's not.
Well, actually, you know something, believe it or not, I have Ladino blood, which in my past, I have, several relatives from Spain originally, who were thrown out of Spain in 1492. So I could argue.
You could make that argument.
Yeah. So
more authentic than someone from Costa Rica, probably. Yeah,
absolutely. So. Anyway, so I think we've hit the high points on the Senate. I'm trying to think. New Hampshire.
Okay, so let me give you my three dark horse ones.
Good.
So I'm kind of paying attention to three. Okay, so let's talk the major races. Alaska, as much as I hate it, probably Murkowski is going to come out of that one winning simply because that stupid ranked choice system, who can figure this thing out? But we'll see. I have hope. She's disliked, but she'll probably still manage to pull this one off. Masters should win. Laxalt should win. Walker will win in Georgia. I don't think there's any question there. The ones that nobody really talking about, J.D. Vance is going to win in Ohio. Schmidt is going to win in Missouri.
So you're, why at, 50, so why you're people, at 52 right now.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I'm at 52. Okay. I'm at 52. I think 52 is almost a lock. And you could have something like Laxalt or Masters lose. I don't think both of them do. I could see that happening, but then that would be balanced by Oz winning. Okay, so it's a matter of, it's kind of an odds thing here. You know, there I think there are four races that are highly likely, three races highly likely to go Republican, plus Oz, I think, is probably a 50-50. Between them, I think you're looking at probably, you know, 52 at the end, assuming something could go wrong somewhere. Races people keep trying to make competitive, like Rubio in Florida, are not competitive. That's not going to happen.
How about North Carolina?
That one's done.
Okay.
That's not competitive at all. What's his name? I had it. And shoot. Anyway, Trump endorsed.
Ted Budd is the
The
Republican. I don't remember the Democrat though.
Yeah. Budd is the and he's Trump endorsed. He's a pretty MAGA guy. You know, okay. And he's going to be a nice upgrade for North Carolina from Tillis. Same thing. J.D. Vance is going to be a big upgrade in Ohio. Schmidt's going to be a big upgrade in Missouri. Okay, so McConnell right there has already lost three votes.
I love it. Say that again, please.
If McConnell has lost three votes.
That's marvelous. So let's get back to dark horses.
Okay, so dark horses. I don't know enough about New Hampshire, but I do know that the voters in New Hampshire are not on board. Is it Shaheen? No, Hassan. That's right. Hassan. Yeah, Maggie Hassan. She has not made the sale yet. There's a lot of undecideds up there. Plus, it's a very late primary. That's one where the Democrats are making their, I think it's a dumb play, where they think that if they can get MAGA candidates, that they'll run better against them. And that's just going to end up hurting them. Mm-hmm. Because in all the primaries so far, the MAGA candidates are receiving way more votes, a lot more enthusiasm than for the establishment. I think New Hampshire has, I think maybe not 50-50, maybe it's a 60-40 kind of thing. But I think the Republican has a good chance in New Hampshire. Two dark horses to watch for, Connecticut and Colorado. I mean, I would be shocked by both of those, but both of those candidates are vulnerable. And, you know, I'm seeing some strange polling out of Connecticut where every so often somebody pops up. So it wouldn't surprise me in the least if Blumenthal were to lose that in Connecticut. It'd be a shock. It'd be the same kind of thing as New Jersey governor last year that almost lost.
Yeah. And they found a bunch of votes in my county.
Yeah, of course. They
and
did.
Yeah.
This is why
40,000 in Bergen County. All of a sudden,
you know, just, yeah, oh, hey, we forgot these. They were just sitting here over here at the back room. For some reason, we forgot to count those. So in any case, I don't think that either of those are going to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think these are the what could happen if you had the entire Republican Party rowing in the same direction right now. You could not only win, you would hold Pennsylvania, you would flip Arizona, Nevada, and Georgia. You would hold, you know, easily, you know, wipe out in Florida, Ohio, Missouri, North Carolina, and then possibly be looking at flipping New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Colorado. And then you're sitting at what, 56?
Yeah.
At that point?
That's amazing. Yeah.
You could get there. Now, it probably won't happen because, you know, the Republicans are playing to lose, as you said. You know, so in a true over-the-top red wave, you could see those kinds of seats flip, which probably won't. But given the mood of the country, would not surprise me in the least. And also assuming a fair election, which is, as we learned, is a pretty unlikely event in many cases.
Well, the Republican Party is reminding me more and more of the Palestinians who, you know, the famous saying about them is that they never lose an opportunity to lose an opportunity.
Very true. Very, very true. So, hey, let me do a quick hit, kind of an ace thing.
Absolutely.
I've got three numbers. These are nationwide numbers. Trump versus Biden, Trump versus Harris, and Trump versus Newsom. You want to hear him?
Sure. Oh, Newsom. He's my favorite.
Okay, so for I know you're a DeSantis guy, but this is why Trump not only is very likely to run and is very likely to win. Trump versus Biden, 44.4% to 39.5%.
Wow.
That's a 6-point lead nationwide that Trump currently holds over Biden. Okay, so you say, oh, Biden, he's demented. He won't make it to the 2024. Who are they going to put up against Trump in that case? Well, let's say they decide to go for Kamala Harris instead. 45.9 to 35.8.
Oh.
That is a 10-point lead for Trump against Kamala Harris. You say, well, there's no way they would put Kamala Harris up. You know, she is not positioned for a success. So they're obviously going to go to the fair-haired politician from California that has just won re-election and is favored by Nancy Pelosi. Donald Trump is leading Gavin Newsom nationwide right now, 46.5 to 27.1. That is a 19-point lead. Gavin Newsom is not competitive. Everybody can just quit worrying about him.
One of the things that interests me about our unfortunately compliant media is that they see these overwhelming numbers. For instance, Newsom, I mean, he's a great example. They see, you know, it's the biggest state in the country, and he won his election by, you know, 20 or 25 points. And they think that that translates into national power. The problem is that as California shifts farther and farther to the left, they are also shifting further and further away from the typical American voter. And this is obvious stuff. I'm not saying anything that's even remotely clever. Unfortunately, our media don't understand that. And it's to our advantage, obviously. If the numbers that you just quoted are even close to correct, then my God, I am going to campaign for Newsom as the Democrat candidate for president in 2024.
I highly encourage the Democrats to realize Biden can't possibly win. They should be replacing him on the ticket with someone younger and more and looks better on TV. A guy by the name of Gavin Newsom is the obvious choice that they should be going with, unless they can get Alexander, you know, AOC to run instead.
Listen, new blood, fantastic.
Yeah,
she's young,
I think
she's
we
vibrant,
need it.
She's energetic.
Young, vibrant, absolutely.
Fantastic. Anyway, I have run far, far longer than I promised Dave in Florida, so I'm going to end this extremely interesting, almost hour. Dave, thank you very, very much. I know it's a bit wonky for our typical listeners, but I think it's vital that we understand how the polling process works and how these numbers are shifting as we get closer and closer to the election. So once again, folks, vote early, vote often, and, you know, if you got to let the air out of the tires of your Democrat neighbor, well, do it on election morning.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Dave and Florida, thank you very much for joining us. This is Cut Chip Newsletter Speaks, and we'll hopefully see you next week, folks. Thanks for listening.